I want you to picture a scenario for a second. It's something so incredibly mundane. You know, you probably did it this morning without even realizing it. You're just standing at a window in your home.
Right.
Maybe you have a hot cup of coffee in your hands, the steam is rising, and you're just, well, you're looking out at the street, you're watching the sunlight hit the pavement, watching a neighbor walk their dog. You're just observing the world.
Yeah, and there's actually a very specific psychology to that classic sort of contemplative moment. You're witnessing the outside world, but you are separated by this invisible, almost sacred barrier of glass.
Totally.
And that thin sheet of silica is silently communicating to your brain that you are completely untouchably safe from whatever's happening out on that street.
It really is the ultimate shield, isn't it? Like, you get to be a spectator in your own little private sanctuary. But now I want you to imagine what happens to your central nervous system, what happens to that baseline feeling of safety when that window is no longer a pristine, transparent pane of
Right
glass.
when it breaks.
Exactly. Imagine that instead it is a jagged, ragged hole that has just been violently blown out of your living room wall by a massive detonation.
Oh man, I mean, the entire dynamic of power, of security, of your personal geometry, it just shatters in a fraction of a second. The boundary between the private sanctuary and the violent public sphere is completely erased.
It vaporizes completely. And suddenly, what's on the other side of that shattered frame isn't sunlight or, you know, society going about its daily routine. It is this implacable, terrifying, incandescent wall of fire. And that visceral rupture, that exact horrifying moment where the domestic sanctuary collides head-on with absolute destruction, that is the focal point of our deep dive today.
We are exploring a really profound question. What is the ethical responsibility of art during times of violent, ongoing conflict?
And we have an incredibly dense, multi-layered stack of materials to guide us through this question today. We're looking at a highly technical breakdown provided by an artist alongside a deeply philosophical, critical essay from a book titled Trastio.
And both of these texts are hyper-focused on analyzing a single, very urgent watercolor painting by the artist Jairo Duque. The piece is titled Yusuf and Sarah.
But before we start unpacking the actual brush strokes and, you know, the incredible technical choices and the psychology behind this painting, we really need to take a deliberate pause.
Yeah, this is important.
It's vital that we establish the gravity and the reality of the sources we are looking at today. The documents we're analyzing, both the artist's own public statements and the critical essay from Trastio, they explicitly discuss highly politically charged real-world
They
themes.
do. The source texts are deeply rooted in the current devastating reality of the Middle East. They explicitly discuss the systemic violence against Palestinians in Gaza, allegations of genocide, and the fundamental right to self-determination.
Right.
And the artwork itself is framed by the artist and the author as a direct vocal protest regarding these specific ongoing events.
So I want to say directly to you listening to this right now, our mission on this deep dive is to impartially report on these documents. We are here to understand the artist's message, the mechanical choices he made, and the author's critical framework.
Exactly.
We are not here to debate or endorse or take sides on the geopolitical viewpoints presented in the texts. Our goal is strictly to dissect this artwork as a cultural and historical document, using their own words and their analysis as our map.
That framing is essential, I think. We're examining how an artist attempts to process overwhelming collective trauma and how they navigate their ethical responsibility using nothing but the physical medium of paint, water, and paper.
Yeah, so with the gravity of our mission clearly established, let's step into the visual landscape of this painting, because to really grasp the weight of the message, you need to see the scene in your mind's eye.
The visual contrast Duke creates in this piece is just immediately startling. The composition places the viewer directly inside a devastated domestic interior.
Right in the rubble.
Right. What used to be a living room, a place of comfort, is now just reduced to jagged concrete and ruins. And right in the center, dominating the entire canvas, is this irregular, jagged void in the wall.
Yeah, the blown out window.
Exactly. Through that broken hole, you are staring out into a fuels incandescent fire that seems to just consume the entire outside world.
And right there, standing perfectly still in the threshold of this ruin, with their backs completely turned to us, are two small children.
Just looking out into the flames. And one of the children is tightly hugging a small pet to their chest.
Wow.
Yeah, and the Trastio essay really emphasizes the psychology of their posture. Because they are perfectly quiet. They're stoic. They aren't running in a panic. They aren't screaming.
They're just frozen.
Yes. There is this heavy, unnatural, almost adult resignation in the way they're standing.
You know, reading through those visual descriptions in the sources, a very specific analogy popped into my head. That ragged hole in the wall, it behaves almost exactly like a movie theater screen.
Oh, that's interesting.
Or like, you know, the viewfinder on a camera. It perfectly frames this overwhelming terror for the viewer, but it comes with this horrifying inverted twist.
How so?
Well, if you're watching a scary movie in a theater, you feel fear, right? But your brain knows you can stand up, walk past the velvet curtains, and go home to safety.
Right, the glass barrier we talked about earlier.
Exactly. But the spectators here, these two small children, they are physically trapped inside the ruined theater itself. They have the complete paralysis of a spectator, but absolutely none of the safety. The horror isn't a projection. It's literally waiting at their doorstep.
You're hitting on a crucial mechanism there, and it actually closely mirrors the critical analysis in Trestio. The author explicitly describes that hole in the blasted wall as functioning simultaneously as a window and a stage.
A window and a stage.
Yeah. And the artwork makes a very deliberate ethical choice to avoid those wide sweeping aerial shots of apocalyptic bombings we usually see on the news.
Right, the drone footage.
Exactly. You don't see the macro level geopolitics. You don't see the whole city burning from a drone's perspective.
It denies you that emotional distance because when you look at a drone shot of a ruined city, it feels abstract. It almost looks like a map, you know?
Completely. Instead, the artist forces the perspective into this tiny, claustrophobic, incredibly intimate anchor point. And the essay uses this phenomenal phrase to describe the effect. It says it proves that horror doesn't need to scream. It simply filters through the window.
It simply filters through the window. God, that is chilling. Because it describes a completely contained horror.
It really does.
And here is where the source material gets deeply fascinating to me. Because it isn't just what the artist painted that is telling this story. It is the actual physics of how he painted it. Like, the physical materials themselves are acting out the trauma on the canvas.
Yeah, the technical breakdown of this painting is vital to understanding its ethical weight. The medium literally mirrors the message.
Right.
Duke chose to use a very specific foundation for this. It's 100% cotton arches paper. Now, that might sound standard until you look at the weight. It is 640 grams per square meter.
Okay, let's contextualize that number for a second, because when I read it, I had to look up what that actually feels like.
Yes, not normal paper.
Not at all. If you grab a standard piece of printer paper from your desk right now, that is about 80 grams. It flops around. This 640 gram watercolor paper is basically as thick, dense, and rigid as heavy-duty packing cardboard.
It is intensely structural. The paper is extremely thick, and it is what is known as cold pressed, which means it has a very rough grain.
Okay.
The essay argues this choice is a mechanical metaphor for the conflict itself. Think about the physics of watercolor as a medium. It is inherently destructive.
Because of the water.
Exactly. You are flooding a vulnerable surface with water and pigment. A standard piece of 80 gram paper would instantly warp, buckle, disintegrate, and tear under that kind of fluid aggression.
But this 640-gram paper mechanically fights back. It can take a massive amount of fluid and violence without losing its structural integrity.
Yes, precisely.
So it is acting exactly like the physical shelter the painting depicts. The paper itself is trying to withstand the assault, just like the concrete walls of that ruined home.
The paper acts as the physical shelter, yes. And it gets deeper because the artist pairs this unyielding, sheltering paper with a very specific type of chemical attacker.
The paint itself.
Right. He utilizes Daniel Smith granulating pigments.
Which behave on a microscopic level very differently from normal watercolors, right?
Entirely differently. When you use standard watercolors, the pigments are ground so finely that they dissolve smoothly. They're designed to create even, beautiful washes of color.
Like a smooth sunset.
Right. Granulating pigments are not like that. They are incredibly heavy. They're made of actual tiny mineral particles and crushed stones. When you mix them with water, they do not dissolve perfectly.
They clump together.
They clump, they separate from the water, and because they're heavy, they sink. And remember how we mentioned the paper was cold pressed?
Yeah, the rough grain.
Right. During manufacturing, it's pressed through cold metal rollers instead of hot ones, which intentionally leaves deep microscopic craters all over the surface of the paper. Those heavy mineral shards from the paint settle irregularly deep into those rough crevices.
So when the water finally evaporates from the canvas, it literally leaves behind this gritty, textured, uneven residue.
Exactly.
And the sources describe it as chemically mimicking the toxic air, the suspended dust, and the gritty debris of an actual explosion. I mean, you aren't just looking at a painting of rubble on a microscopic chemical level. You are looking at actual mineral rubble permanently trapped inside the craters of the paper.
It creates a completely tactile atmosphere of devastation. The chemistry of the paint and the physics of the paper are doing the heavy lifting of the narrative here.
I find that technical synergy just incredible. But, you know, digging into the sources, I do have to push back on one particular detail that jumped out at me.
Ooh,
What's that?
the timeline of this artwork's creation.
Ah, yes, the chronological data is certainly striking.
It's wild. According to the documentation, the primary reference image for this painting was a photograph taken during a protest in California in November 2023.
Right.
Yet this incredibly layered, technically complex watercolor was already framed, shipped, and hanging in an art gallery in Dubai by December 2023.
Just weeks later.
Exactly. We're talking about a turnaround of mere weeks. Usually, when we think of profound, historically significant art tackling war, you know, something like Picasso's Guernica, we assume it requires the dust to settle.
Right, a period of gestation.
Yeah, we assume an artist needs a decade of historical reflection to create something profound. Doesn't this urgent journalistic speed risk sacrificing that artistic depth? Like, doesn't it just turn the painting into a reactionary social media post rendered in watercolor?
It's a very fair question, but the Trasteo essay anticipates that exact challenge. It directly rebuts the assumption that time equals depth in this scenario.
Okay, how so? The author clarifies that in this context, the hyperspeed is exactly the point. The artist's ethical responsibility here is not to sit back, wait for the geopolitical dust to settle, and eventually create something purely aesthetic to hang in a comfortable museum 10 years from now.
I guess the luxury of reflection really belongs to peacetime.
That is exactly it. The ethical mandate for Duke is to document the horror in real time. He is abandoning the traditional, leisurely function of fine art in order to create a brutal, immediate historical record.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, the speed of the brushstrokes is a direct testament to the urgency of the violence. It shifts the role of the artist from a reflective philosopher looking back at history to an emergency first responder trying to capture the evidence before it is literally swept away.
Wow, an emergency first responder. So if the paper is the physical shelter and the paint is the chemical debris attacking it, that brings us to who is left standing inside that shelter.
The children.
Right, the actual human subjects of the painting. And this involves some of the most profound ethical choices in the entire piece.
This is perhaps the most heavily analyzed portion of the Trasteo essay, actually. Because the core question is, how do you ethically paint the victims of an ongoing horrific conflict without inadvertently exploiting their trauma?
And this is where I experienced genuine conceptual friction when I first read the materials. The artist is trying to create this urgent, highly empathetic, historically vital document.
Right.
But the two children standing in the center of the painting, the subjects we're supposed to connect with, are rendered as completely dark silhouettes. They have absolutely no facial features.
None at all. They're just dark shadows backlit by the immense fire outside.
So my immediate instinct was, wait, doesn't this run the severe risk of erasing their humanity?
How do you mean?
Well, human beings connect with faces. If you strip away a child's eyes, their expressions, don't they just become a cliche? Or worse, just another anonymous statistic, which is, you know, exactly the kind of dehumanization the artist is supposed to be fighting against.
You are touching on the complex psychology of how our brains process images of suffering. And the expert analysis in Trasteo unpacks this facelessness not as an erasure, but as a stroke of technical and ethical genius.
Really? How does that work?
Let's look at the mechanism. First, the silhouette universalizes the pain. When our brain sees a specific face, it immediately categorizes it: age, demographic, origin.
Oh, I see.
Because these shadows lack those specific identifying features, they cease to be just two specific children. They become any child of that generation caught in this conflict. They become archetypes of a collective regional trauma.
So our brain can't categorize them and just file them away. We have to project our own empathy onto the shadow.
Exactly. Furthermore, and perhaps more importantly, the ethical argument, the facelessness intentionally avoids melodrama.
Melodrama.
Think about the devastating images that go viral on social media. They almost always feature extreme, visible, agonizing facial expressions.
Right, people crying, screaming.
Yes. By denying the viewer a painted crying face, The artist refuses to manipulate your baser emotional instincts. He refuses to, as the essay so powerfully puts it, mercantilize childhood trauma for a cheap, momentary emotional reaction.
By not giving us the tears, he is actively protecting the dignity of those subjects. He is telling the viewer, you know, you do not get to consume their grief that easily.
Precisely.
You don't get to look at a crying face, feel a momentary pang of pity, and then scroll away feeling like you've done your moral duty.
It demands more from you.
But that creates a tension for me. If they are universal shadows, how does the artist anchor them back to reality? How do we remember that they are real people and not just philosophical symbols?
He anchors their identity outside the physical canvas itself.
With the title.
Exactly. He does it with the title of the piece, Yusuf and Sarah.
Right. By assigning these featureless shadows real specific human names, he pulls them right back down to earth.
It is a brilliant psychological paradox.
It really is. You look at an anonymous shadow, but your brain reads a human name. It forces you to remember that every single anonymous casualty statistic you see flashing on the bottom of the nightly news had a routine. They had a favorite toy, they had a family, they had a home.
And they had pets.
Oh.
Which brings us to the detail of the child holding the animal in the ruins.
Oh, yeah.
The essay highlights this specific choice as a vital concluding ethical layer.
That detail is the one that really anchors the heartbreak for me. Amidst this literal apocalypse, this roaring inferno of concrete and fire, this child's arms are tightly wrapped around a small, fragile animal.
The author of the essay argues this shows that even in the absolute abyss of destruction, the most primordial human instinct is not violence. It is care.
That's beautiful.
It is the instinct to protect something even more vulnerable than yourself. And in the context of the essay's broader political analysis, this simple act of compassion becomes the purest, most undeniable form of political resistance against the machinery of steel and fire.
It is resistance through tenderness. Like, you can destroy the walls, but you haven't destroyed the instinct to care.
Exactly.
And the essay connects that idea of holding on to a core identity to another small detail hidden in the rubble, the Palestinian flag hanging in the background of the ruined room.
Right, and the sources make a very deliberate point of stating this isn't placed there as a hollow political slogan or, you know, a piece of state propaganda.
Yeah, the critical text interprets the presence of the flag very intimately, moving away from macropolitics. In a landscape where the physical home has been utterly pulverized by explosives, that flag serves as the very last surviving vestige of cultural belonging. It represents the psychological home, clinging on when the physical one is gone.
And that loss, the loss of both the physical home and the psychological home, perfectly sets up the absolute core thesis of this entire deep dive.
Right.
Everything we've discussed so far, the rigid mechanical paper, the gritty mineral pigment, the ethical speed, the names, the shadows, it all builds toward one devastating psychological concept introduced by the Trostio book.
The concept of intimate displacement.
Yes, intimate displacement.
You know, when I hear the word displacement, my brain immediately goes to logistics. I think of refugee camps, massive columns of people moving across borders, physical evictions, losing the deed to a house. It is treated like a real estate or a geography problem on the news.
That's the standard definition, yes.
But adding the word intimate to it is the author suggesting the eviction is happening inside the child's mind.
The text argues exactly that. Intimate displacement asserts that the true, lasting tragedy of conflict isn't just the logistical loss of the walls and the roof.
Right.
It is the violent, irreversible eradication of a child's internal emotional refuge. It is the permanent displacement of their fundamental right to innocence and safety.
Their internal psychological sanctuary is blown out, leaving a jagged hole, just like the concrete wall in the painting.
That's exactly the metaphor.
I mean, you can eventually rebuild a physical city. You can pour new concrete and lay bricks back down in 5 or 10 years. But the mechanism of trauma is permanent. How do you rebuild the internal psychological landscape of a child who has been forced to stand in that threshold and watch their entire world burn? You can't just tell their brain to unsee the fire.
You can't. And actually, the color palette of the painting is deliberately engineered to emphasize this internal eradication.
Oh, the colors.
Yes. Notice the extreme restraint Duke uses. Outside the broken window, you have these violent, chaotic, fiery oranges and intense yellows consuming everything.
The fire.
Right. But the inside, representing the interior psychological world of the children, is completely drained of energy. It is painted in muted, lifeless ochres and ashy grays.
And the essay specifically points out the use of the color black here too, right?
It does.
The artist restricted the use of pure black paint exclusively to the deepest, most severe cracks in the ruined walls. He didn't just wash the whole interior scene in black to artificially make it look sad or gloomy.
And that restraint ties directly back to avoiding melodrama. By withholding the extreme darkness, the reality of the gray, ashy interior hits the viewer much harder. It forces the viewer to fully adopt the children's psychological point of view, standing in the gray ash looking out at the fire.
Wow.
As the artist Jero Duke firmly states in the source material, he utterly rejects any pretension of artistic neutrality. The mechanics of the painting physically trap you in that ruined room alongside them.
And that entrapment brings me to this immense psychological paradox I've been chewing on ever since I read these sources.
What's the paradox?
Well, we live in an era where our brains are constantly bombarded with hyperkinetic, deafening footage, right?
Oh, absolutely.
You open your phone right now and you can instantly watch frantic, noisy, high-definition videos of actual bombings, actual tragedies, on an infinite, never-ending scroll.
Yeah, the technological barrier to witnessing graphic violence has never been lower in human history.
Exactly. Yet somehow, this completely quiet, static, modestly sized watercolor painting of two featureless shadows looking out a window, it is significantly harder to sustain eye contact with than a visceral, viral video on social media.
It's true.
Why does the brain react that way? Why does the static paint hit harder than the high-definition pixel?
The mechanism comes down to passive versus active consumption.
Okay, unpack that.
The viral video, the doom scroll, actually protects you. It allows you to remain a passive consumer of tragedy. You watch it for 3 seconds, your brain feels overwhelmed, and you simply flick your thumb and scroll past it.
Right, onto a video of a cat or someone baking bread.
Exactly. The tragedy washes over you like scenery from a speeding train. But this watercolor artwork, because of its stillness, its silence, and its lack of faces, corners your mind.
It demands your active imagination.
Yes. You have to fill in the silence of those children. You have to mentally project the heat of that fire.
And because it doesn't do the emotional work for you, it strips away that protective window glass we talked about at the very beginning of the show.
It shatters the glass. It forces you to stand in that ruined threshold. And according to the author's critical analysis, it forces you to recognize a fundamental ethical baseline.
Which is?
That absolutely no geopolitical cause, no abstract political argument, and no historical grievance justifies the extermination of civilians or the permanent destruction of a child's internal sanctuary.
That is just intruvant. It has been an incredibly heavy mechanical and philosophical journey we've been on today.
It really has.
We started by looking at the literal physics of art. How the microscopic craters of a 640-gram piece of cold-pressed cotton paper can mechanically fight back against an aggressive flood of water and heavy mineral pigment.
Right.
We saw how the artists leveraged incredible technical speed not to be careless, but to fulfill an ethical mandate as a first responder to trauma.
And we unpacked the complex psychology of representation, you know, discovering how denying us the painted faces of Yusuf and Sarah paradoxically forced us to project our own empathy onto them.
Saving their humanity from the cheap, consumable melodrama of our daily news feeds. And we arrived at that heartbreaking psychological thesis of intimate displacement. The profound reality that the deepest, most permanent casualties of conflict aren't just concrete buildings, but the fundamental human right to feel safe inside your own mind.
Ultimately, the enduring takeaway from these sources is a really powerful statement on the role of art today.
Yeah.
In our current era of hyperinformation, where we endlessly, numbly scroll through tragedy to protect our own sanity, art still holds a supreme ethical responsibility.
Not just to reflect, but to confront.
Right. Its job isn't to shout louder than the algorithmic noise. Its job is to demand silence, corner our minds, and force us to actively feel the true, unyielding weight of human pain.
That leaves me with a final thought I want you to mull over today, something that builds on this idea of the internal psychological landscape.
Okay.
If intimate displacement is the violent, irreversible destruction of our internal emotional refuges, how might the art, the stories, and the human connections we create tomorrow serve as the blueprint to rebuild those sanctuaries?
That's a profound question.
Long after the physical bricks of these broken cities have been laid back down, how do we use art and narrative to help the now generation paint an entirely new window, one they can actually feel safe looking out of again?
It's going to take a lot of work.
It is a massive question, but it's something worth thinking about. Until then, take a moment to truly appreciate the safety of the view from your own window today. Always seek out the original sources, stay curious, and always welcome multiple perspectives. Catch you next time on The Deep Dive.